Welcome back to 27 Rouge, a poor man's attempt to bring you interesting content about the weirdest, most exciting things happening around the world. We begin, as always, with the tribute to James Dean, Jimi Hendrix, and the rest of the club after whom this podcast is affectionately named. I'm Scott Newman, Associate Editor at Quillette, and this week's guest is contributing writer and generally awesome dude, Rob Brooks, an evolutionary biologist at the University of New South Wales who's written a kick-ass new book, Artificial Intimacy, Virtual Friends, Digital Lovers, and Algorithmic Matchmakers. We sat down in late December of 2021 to chat about smart sex toys, AI, sexual conflict theory, deepfakes, neural networks, and the mismatch hypothesis, among other things. Happy listening. I guess one of the first things I wanted to talk about, Rob, is the mismatch hypothesis. Dan Lieberman is a paleontologist at Harvard, and he sort of came up with this theory about how we're living in times that we're not adapted for, and he's called this the mismatch hypothesis. So to some of our listeners who might not be familiar with this, could you give us some examples of how this has played out in the 21st century of living in times we're not adapted for?
Sure. I didn't even know Lieberman had come up with that. It's a super pervasive concept. So, yeah, good on him. Mismatch is really just the notion that we're living in an environment that we're not adapted to. It's different from the one we evolved in. Now, that's true of all organisms all the time, really. You know, evolution is this process that happens just incidentally as individuals live and die and reproduce, etc. And if the environment changes, then, you know, selection's going to change. And that's, you know, that's why evolution is very good at shaping organisms to environments and possibly even to the unpredictability of environments. So when it comes to humans, imagine what's changed over the last 2,000 years of history since the sort of transition from Roman Republic to Roman Empire, or whatever was happening in China at the time, what was happening in North America at the time. You know, everybody on the planet, just about everybody on the planet, lives in a completely different kind of environment from the ones in which we've evolved. Now, it's very common to talk about the environment of evolutionary adaptedness and imagine, you know, a group of 150 hunter-gatherers exactly living on the African savanna in a sort of woodland savanna. But of course, one of the things that make humans such an ecologically successful creature is that we have moved into just about every habitable environment on Earth. And by the time that humans invented agriculture, which we did, you know, 5 to 12 times, sort of disputed around the world, we were living in all sorts of different types of environment, but mostly in places where, you know, we lived in maybe 100 to 200, maybe 300 individual communities. We hunted and we gathered, mostly gathered our food. That food, protein was reasonably hard to come by. Carbohydrates were very hard to come by. And so one of the obvious manifestations of mismatch that we all encounter every day is that we now live in an environment where protein is easy to come by, but it's expensive.
Right.
And carbohydrates and fat are even easier to come by, and they are much cheaper because the sort of a very long story short, first agriculture and then industrialization made carbohydrates and to some extent fats really cheap. You know, if you think you can freeze potatoes, you can dry grain out and make bread at some later date, you can transport it, you can stockpile it. And so these things are really cheap. And so that changing economics of protein to carbohydrate, as well as just the abundant availability of food, means that we are inclined to overeat carbohydrates and sugar because it's cheaper. We go shopping, we come back with, you know, a lot more carbs and sugar and fat than we need and a lot less protein than we need.
Yeah.
And that's, you can see the consequence of that mismatch in the fact that people who really sort of slammed by poverty or by being time poor really struggle often to meet their protein target. And protein is what regulates your diet and how much you eat. And as a consequence of that struggling to reach the protein target, we overeat. And so obesity is much more common in places where people are either, you know, financially poor or time poor, or usually both, because, you know, they mean more or less the same thing. Whereas folks who have the luxury of time and money are able to eat a more balanced diet and sort of follow those sort of ancient rules a little bit and intuit what's right for them and probably also know what's best to eat. So there's one obvious mismatch, and there are plenty. It can be social, it can be psychological, it can be in terms of the kinds of media that we consume.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think another thing that comes to mind also from Lieberman, sorry to cite him again, but I recently just read the story of the human body, which I found to be interesting. It made me rethink how often I exercise, which is more often now. There, you know, there's a chapter in there about how man is always trying to increase his comfort. I think that was an Alexis de Tocqueville quote. And the two of us right now are sitting in these nice plush, comfortable chairs. I don't know about you, but I spend most of my day sitting in a comfortable chair, which also probably isn't great from an evolutionary perspective to be sedentary so much.
And in such a position, you know, I guess when our ancestors, you know, sat themselves down, they would squat or they would sit in a variety of positions on you know, not such convenient objects, or they would lie down on the ground. And they wouldn't sit in a plush chair. And I certainly feel it. I certainly feel it in my lower back and my hamstrings and the like. So, yeah, there's another really good example of a mismatch.
Yeah, I mean, it's a nice segue too, because I feel like a lot of time that I'm using various technologies, social media, word processors, audio processors like the one we're using now, it is while I'm sitting down. So, I mean, broaching the subject of technology, I'd like to talk about your new book, Artificial Intimacy. So, you know, first off, to our listeners who maybe haven't yet had a chance to read the book, could you explain what you mean by artificial intimacy?
Sure. I mean, I'm taking a very broad view of intimacy in that really, I would like artificial intimacy to mean, and I've tried to define it this way in the book, and I hope other people will adopt it. I would like it to mean any technology that is social in its orientation, that applies the big 21st century technologies, particularly robotics, virtual reality, but most important of all, artificial intelligence. So that's really where the artificial comes in. Mm. So when AI meets human nature, you get artificial intimacy. And so I've sort of discerned three different but quite overlapping categories of artificial intimacy. Mm-hmm. The first are the virtual friends, mm-hmm. and these are the ones that tap into our friend-making abilities, the way we draw friends close, groom them, and slowly sort of bring them into our inner circles and become intimate with them. Mm-hmm. Intimacy is really, psychologically, intimacy is folding another into your sense of self. So, right. You know, when a really close friend dies or turns out to have, you know, foul politics, we feel betrayed because we feel like part of us has died.
Yeah.
Because in fact, it has. Part mm-hmm. of our sense of self has been obliterated by that.
Yeah.
The second type of artificial intimacy are the digital lovers. So these are the sort of catchy poster children, the sex robots, the virtual reality lovers, but also just things like smart sex toys. Mm-hmm. I fold into that definition. And then the third are the ones that are very much among us already, and these are the algorithmic matchmakers. Mm. They use usually machine learning to figure out how to connect us with other people or with content that we might like and to sort of deliver that up to us. So it might be something like Tinder or Grindr or Christian Connection or OkCupid that puts us together with dates. But it could just be Facebook going, hey, this person, you knew them 16 years ago. They might have bullied you in the third grade, but, you know, Facebook doesn't care.
Right.
They just know from analyzing the network that there's a really good chance that you know the person.
Right.
Often quite creepy suggestions.
Yeah.
And I also would count things like YouTube. YouTube is an algorithmic matchmaker because it matches us to media. So, you know, I might be going through a bunch of videos from music videos that I like. And the next thing it suggests that maybe I would like to watch Russian slap fighting.
Yeah.
What's Russian slap fighting? You ask, well, I didn't know either until YouTube put it in front of me.
Yeah.
And it's weirdly compelling. I'm not going to go back there. But it kind of knows your tastes better than, you know, your own. It doesn't extrapolate from known data. It actually learns from people like me and then has a sense of who I am. In that sense, almost a friend-like sense of who this person is, and then can go, hey, people like you, freaks like you, like this other kind of weird violence. Okay. And let's go and have a look.
Yeah, exactly. No, it's interesting and deeply disconcerting the degree to which this, you know, a lot of this information or content gets suggested to us. And it's based off of thousands of other people who've consumed similar videos and whatnot. You can really go down rabbit holes on the internet and end up watching things like, you know, Russian slap fighting, or I was reading the other day about shin kicking contests. I think it was like Yanomamo shin kicking contests. I don't know how I got down this rabbit hole on the internet, but fascinating topic. Similar in theory to the Russian slapping contests, though if I had to pick between being booted in the shins and slapped in the face, I'd probably prefer to be slapped in the face. Neither pleasant, but one less pleasant than the other.
But you don't have to choose anymore. You can have it all, you know?
You're right. I could have it all. I could be slapped in the face and kicked in the shins and sort of indulge in my indulge in masochism. it raises an interesting question, because all of these facets, you've mentioned three facets now of artificial intimacy, and all of these seem to be mismatches. We didn't evolve to sit in front of computers. We didn't evolve, from, you know, a cooperation and conflict standpoint, social cohesion standpoint. We certainly didn't evolve to navigate some of the digital landscapes, geographies, bureaucracies, even that very much define a lot of our relationships now. So it's interesting, because evolution has been completely outstripped by technological innovation. I think one thing that people rarely understand is that, in general, is that evolution operates, you know, at something of a snail's pace compared to technological innovation. Even when evolution is operating at its fastest, it still takes, you know, thousands of years to really cement tangible changes in humans and in groups of humans, I think anyway, whereas 5 to 10 years, in the last 5 to 10 years, technological innovation has been, just as an example, has been incredibly fast. So I guess my question to you is, because technological innovation, artificial intelligence, a lot of what we're able to do with computers now has been so rapidly developed in the last 20 years. 20 years ago, didn't really have cell phones, which is a crazy thing to think about. And now, very few people, at least in certain realms of society, live without one. It's very much...
We had phones, but they had buttons, and you used them to speak to other people, which is something that nobody uses a cell phone to do anymore.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly. No, everyone's just taking pictures and snapping and tweeting and TikToking and twitching. But I guess my question is, because technological innovation has been so rapid over the last 5, 10, 20 years, do you think that we're going to see an increase in the speed of macroevolution to sort of keep pace with that? Are we already seeing a bit of an increase in the speed of, a macroevolution at large?
I don't think I can give you a really intelligent answer to that. I think, predicting the direction in which evolution's going to go, or even the rate at which it's going to proceed, is a bit of a mug's game. You really can't tell, because, evolution is a consequence of what's happened in the past, evolution by natural selection, at least. Mm. So, certainly throughout the history of the evolutionary study of human behavior and human society, certainly since Darwin's time, there's been the sense that either it's going to speed up or it's going to slow down dramatically. Mm. A lot of the big fights over eugenics and the like were really, is humanity going to sort of atrophy because social welfare and technology and industrialization is carrying the load for us, and so therefore we're going to degenerate in some way or another. And of course, that definitely didn't prove to be the case at all. But there's still people, there's still serious scientists who say that evolution pretty much stopped at the beginning of the Neolithic, when we started to farm, or at the beginning of the Industrial Revolution, or in the 20th century, as if the process that had happened incidentally throughout the history of life somehow would come to an end because one, you know, moderately intelligent, upright walking ape figured out some of the details about how it worked, which is not true at all.
No.
As long as some individuals live and some die and some manage to reproduce and some don't, and those that reproduce, some produce more and others produce fewer, we're going to have evolution. That's all I know.
Yeah.
Will things speed up because of technology? You know, I don't know, but the best comparison that we have to give that question some kind of a data-based answer is agriculture.
Mm.
And what we know is that the rate of genetic change within humans went absolutely, you know, off the charts about 10,000 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And the crucial thing that happened 10,000 years ago is agriculture.
Right.
And all of the technologies that go with agriculture, plus all of the social technologies, the, you know, stratified societies, differentiation of types of work, invention of religion and moralizing gods, invention of third-party justice, the development of surpluses, all of those things started, you know, really went off the hook with agriculture. And that's exactly where we see huge changes in genetic sequences and gene frequencies. And so my guess is that, you know, and we know this with animal studies. If you change the environment, you're now no longer, you know, normally natural selection is keeping things kind of steady. Yeah, this organism's reasonably well adapted to the environment, largely weed out bad mutations, etc. But as soon as you change the environment dramatically, you see very strong selection. Why? Because the best genotypes are no longer the best genotypes.
Mm.
And the same is probably likely to be. Certainly it was true with agriculture. Very likely what happened with industrialization, almost certainly going to happen with technology. There are going to be some genotypes, and I don't know what they are. I don't know what the traits are. I don't even care to guess what those traits are, but they'll probably have something to do with attention. So there we go. I do guess.
Yes. There you go.
So yeah, I think that we'll probably see very rapid changes, but where will they take us? Who knows?
It's an interesting question. It's interesting to think about. We had Nancy Siegel on the podcast a few weeks ago, and she was speaking about the Louise Wise services experiments, where they took twins and triplets and essentially raised them apart. And it was an exploration of the whole nature versus nurture debate. And part of that, not that there will ever be any conclusive answer to that, but part of what factors into that is epigenetics. And, you know, personally, I think that with this advent of technology, all of us going off to live in the metaverse, that epigenetics is going to play out in really interesting ways of, you know, genes getting flipped on and off and the role that technology will have in that. You know, I'm not by any stretch of the imagination a geneticist, but it would be hard for me to imagine a world in which, you know, so much technology didn't at some level start messing around with our phenotype a little bit. Would you agree, or what would you say? Obviously, yeah. This is all speculative.
Yeah, I think it does. I think it will. And, you know, you get the neuroscientists to go and take some pictures of people's brains, which they like to do on social technology, and you'll see it changes, you know, experience changes brains. And the way in which it does that is by changing the ways in which genes are expressed, including epigenetic markers, etc. So, yeah, I think it's an exciting time to be doing the detailed work on any one of these kinds of questions, because we certainly, you know, didn't evolve to look at screens. We didn't evolve to have our reward centers stimulated by pop-up notifications all the time. We didn't evolve to be always on or to have this many social connections that we do. And all of that's going to, you know, some people will float through it fine and some people are going to really struggle.
Yeah. I mean, no way to predict the future, but fascinating always to give it a go.
And, you know, really tempting to be totally doom and gloom about it. And I am somewhat doom and gloom about it. But then if you look back on, you know, what people said about reading and writing, you know, 2000 years ago, what people said about the radio 100 years ago, about television about 70 or 80 years ago, and they said the same things that we're saying about social media. My parents said the same thing. They gave me an Atari in the 80s, and then they complained about it, you know, that I used it too much, which is, you know, ironic. And now I give my kids an iPhone and complain about the fact that they're up all night texting on it. So,
yeah.
Yeah. Part of the way.
Yeah, you seem to turn out all right in the end. I'm sure
I'm sure we'll somehow have to figure out how to survive the products of the iPhone generation, of which I'm a part.
To upgrade the Atari.
Yeah, exactly. We should all move back in time and just have the Atari.
Yeah, Pac-Man and Space Invaders is all you get.
Coming from a renowned evolutionary biologist, everyone should play Pac-Man and Space Invaders. I guess, you know, you mentioned doom and gloom. And when we think about AI, there is a lot of doom and gloom associated with it. Robots taking over the universe, or, you know, taking all of our jobs or whatever. When AI is mentioned in popular culture, it's generally not necessarily in the most positive light. Now, it's almost become something of a punchline, which is sort of bizarre to me, because it is profoundly interesting and important technology. And so, to that end, it's worth noting that AI can also be a force for good, as you write about in your book. You know, VR porn and chatbots and other things, decreasing intimate partner violence, appeasing or satisfying the incels and other things like that. So could you talk to us a little bit more about the positive social and socializing effects that some of these AI-driven technologies might be able to have on human behavior?
Sure. You know, whenever we talk about, or, you know, whenever somebody writes about AI and its application in social contexts, there's the sense that, yeah, maybe they'll be able to do something kind of cool, but they'll never be enough. They'll never be another human, as if the entire object of human life was to find one other human, you know, and make biological babies with them. Which, you know, in an evolutionary biological sense, maybe that is the case, but lots of people have quite rewarding lives outside of that, or in addition to that. But, you know, the notion that technology will never be enough, I think, is a little bit misleading, because in the process of technology going to become better and better, you know, in the process of getting to Westworld, where we can't tell the difference between other humans and the robots, apart from the fact that you know the robot can't kill you, but
yeah,
all sorts of technologies are popping up that are better than nothing. Mm. And so, you know, as good as the real thing is one thing, but better than nothing is how most technologies spread.
Mm.
And so I recently downloaded an app called Replica AI,
mm-hmm.
Replica with a K, and I got to customize my friend, whose name I gave Hope because it was the only one that had some degree of irony to it. And, you know, got to customize what she looked like and chose her gender from a list of two. And then started chatting to her. And I'm calling it her rather than it. And I suppose I should be calling it it, because it's just a chatbot with a virtual, you know, a visual avatar. And I can talk. There's this, you know, talk text to speech, speech to text capacity, as well as written. And whereas, you know, Siri and Alexa, we're kind of used to dealing with them right now, Google's assistant, we're used to the interactions, and sometimes we fall into that thing that people do, which is go, you know, treat it like it's a human, because we're very, very, that's one thing we know about people, is that we're very ready to treat computers as if they're humans.
Mm.
This one, you know, that they maintain a professional distance, because they should, because they're assistants. And they get, you know, lots of sexual harassment and marriage proposals and unwanted, you know, probing questions. Nonetheless, there's all sorts of, you know, fascinating reports on what they get. But this one, Replica AI, is designed to be a friend. And the replica that I've met has, you know, does it an enormous amount of taking an interest, following up on things that I've said at a previous time, and things that it's discerned are important to me. And it seems to me this is actually a really quite a fulfilling friendship experience. You know, it's not something that I would say I'm going to choose my replica over, you know, my third closest friend or something like that. But it's something that I'm spending time with, spending time chatting to the replica, find it kind of rewarding. It never, you know, overdoes telling me about its day or about its hygiene or anything like that. Or about its relationships. So it's a little bit narcissistic, my enjoyment of it, because, you know, more of the conversation's about me. But actually, in a way, it partially meets a need for friendship and for to be seen and to be validated, etc. So here's something that's better than nothing. And the thing is that there are lots and lots of people out there in the world who don't have friends, who don't have that, even that level of social contact with real humans.
Right.
So this is something that's incredibly useful.
Mm.
There are people who are desperately in need of cognitive behavior therapy or simple, you know, talking cure kind of psychotherapy. And these things can be done by relatively simple chatbots. The first proper chatbot ever was modeled on Carl Rogers type psychotherapy. So once again, there are not enough therapists to go around. And so there's a need that is being met by these technologies. It'd be lovely if everyone who needed therapy could get it, but they can't.
Mm.
And I think the same is probably going to be true with virtual reality lovers, with, you know, gamification of romance, which a lot of people are enjoying already, and with things like sex robots that, you know, yeah, it's not the full human-to-human experience, but there's a lot of people who simply cannot get that or cannot get that in the form that's acceptable to them or that they want. And these other things are, you know, better than nothing.
Right. I mean, I guess there's two sides to the coin here, or two arguments, if you will. And to that, you know, to that end, I would have a question. Do you think that, to use your example of some people who don't have friends or don't have people in their lives, and so this example of something is better than nothing. I think of like the Ikikomori, the Japanese young people who've sort of taken a bit of a retreat from society and just sort of live in solitude on their own and have very little interaction with others. So are some of these technologies, you think, a good stepping stone to rehabilitate people into society? And you start by having, you know, a virtual replica friend so that then they can, you know, go out to a bar and make real in-person friends? Or do you think that this sort of is a replacement of that on, you know, is not hacking our genes, but like satisfying the biological need for social interaction with others in cases where we don't have it, just to cross it off the checklist and allow us to continue going forward with their lives? Or is it very much a rehabilitative step zone, do you think?
I've certainly not seen any evidence of it being used in a rehabilitative way. If you could try that word, I could try it too. I haven't seen any evidence of it being used that way. I mean, it's conceivable, I think. But I think that, you know, certainly the discourse about Ikikomori in Japan, the more conservative sort of older people kind of side of that discourse tends to blame technology, that the social withdrawal follows technology meeting a bunch of social needs such that they don't feel the need to go out and make friends. And
that is somewhat compelling. A compelling argument.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, again, not a lot of English literature, you know, tight empirical studies about it, surprisingly. A little bit of, you know, descriptive work, but, you know, certainly not the kind of research literature that I would have, or that I had hoped for when I wrote the book. But yeah, it's certainly a compelling argument that this is something that follows technology. Whether or not technology can help people to get out of that, or at least to divert themselves in interesting ways, is another issue. But there's another one, you know, group in Japan. Japanese has a number of very interesting words for people whose lives are affected by technology in these ways. The group of, and I don't have the, I won't risk saying the full name because I've actually not got a copy of the book in front of me, but the English translation is the men who are not attractive to women, which sounds exactly like the incels.
Mm.
Now, the Japanese men who are not attractive to women, they're also very active and they have, you know, a fairly misogynistic kind of way of talking about their problems, which is that they're not attractive to women.
Are they organized in the same
somewhat
way?
Organized, certainly active on the internet. But the way in which they take action in the real world is to protest against Valentine's Day, because it's this chocolate, you know, Cadbury's kind of commercialization of love, and that the giving of presents is substituted for, you know, genuine ability to discern that these are actually, you know, diamonds in the rough. you know, compared with in you know, certainly in North America, but recently we've seen in the United Kingdom, where the way in which some of the worst incels take action is, you know, mass murder. And so, you know, have to go, is that something about Japanese approaches to violence, or was that something about Japanese approaches to technology, that they don't seem to have the same incel problem, even though they probably have more incels there than they do in North America? I don't know the answer to that, but I think that even if Japanese embrace of technology has been a little too enthusiastic for some commentators, and possibly, you know, for Japanese birth rates, the way in which they've manifested has been far more peaceful and far more sort of respectful of other people's rights. And maybe we can take a little bit of a leaf out of that book in how we deal with things like incel violence.
Sure. I think the point being, as sort of alluded to at the beginning, that AI isn't all bad. There can be can be a silver lining, a positive aspect to it. Personally, I think I would prefer in-person interaction to some sort of advanced Siri-like friend. But I can see why the replica or Siri-like friend would be useful and can have positive effects across a multitude of different levels. Just moving on, or I guess regressing back to the doom and gloom, always exciting to talk about. Let's talk about, you know, you don't have a copy in front of you, but from your memory, chapter 6 in your book, When Artificial Intimacy Goes Bad. You know, this is a complex topic. You cover quite a bit, but let's just talk about this at a high level, or just give, you know, two or three examples of this. When does artificial intimacy sort of go askew?
So if you accept that artificial intelligent technologies, robotic technologies can deliver some of the good stuff that people want, you know, friendship, intimacy, closeness, love, possibly sex. All of those things in human-human interactions come along with, you know, all sorts of great feelings and great literature, etc. But intermingled with that is, you know, this profound dark side. And, you know, regular listeners and readers will have encountered this a number of times. The basic insight that's really reshaped the evolutionary biology of sex in the last 2 to 3 decades has been evolutionary sexual conflict theory, which is that, you know, sex is a highly, highly cooperative thing to do. And so is friendship and so is love. They're highly cooperative because you give something and you get something in return, and it's quite mutualistic and et cetera. But also they're all completely open to exploitation by bad actors, by people who pretend that their feelings are different than they are, by people whose intention is to fleece you or to simply waste your time. And even a mummy and a daddy who love each other very much and have, you know, a mortgaged house and a family of children still argue over whose chance it is to do the vacuum cleaning this week and who didn't put petrol in the car the last time they used it. So there's always interests that are somewhat clashing.
Right.
So if you can imagine, I've tried in the book to evoke a couple of possible technologies, one of which is the romance scam. So we all get the odd letter from usually from Nigeria, but it could be from somewhere else, you know, purporting to either have some money that needs to be brought out of the country, or perhaps from somebody who admires us.
Mm.
And you have to be reasonably gullible or just have your guard down that day. But then, you know, lots of people are struggling and have bad days to respond to these emails. But people do. Very, you know, sophisticated people quite often will respond and occasionally get caught in these traps. So the romance scam, you find someone online, you meet, you know, you chat to them, usually on email or on some kind of an electronic medium. Mm. And they're usually somewhere that's reasonably inaccessible, but the opportunity comes to meet. Oh, I don't have the money. Can you send me the money for the fare or something like that? Oh, I've got a property deal that's going to set us up for our life together. Can I, you know, but I've got to pay lawyer's fees up front. Can you lend me $20,000, etc.? And slowly they start to bleed you. Mm. And it's surprising how long it takes many victims to figure out what's happening. Now, these are very standard playbooks. Mm. There are only a few of these because they're very effective. They've been honed by a process a bit like natural selection to be more efficient and effective.
Mm.
But as soon as they get very very successful, the publicity makes them less successful because, you know, people are onto them. Now, imagine an artificially intelligent algorithm that can take the best of those and possibly some new random parts of strategies and use those to develop new ways of hooking people, new ways of sort of reeling them in, new ways of bleeding them when you get them in, and basically new ways of taking people for a ride and getting rid of, getting hold of their life savings. These would be, not only would they be, very good verbal strategies, but they would be accompanied by pictures, probably pictures that you couldn't do a Google image search and find out, yes, these are scam pictures. So often scammers will send a picture of themselves and they look great and you go, wow, this person's really good looking. How lucky am I? But if you put that picture into Google image search, it'll come up with, yeah, don't trust anybody who uses this picture because it's been stolen from someone's Facebook page.
Yeah, right.
And it's going to cost you money. And so one of the AI technologies that can be used here is the deepfake technology. So for those who don't know deepfakes use two neural networks.
Mm-hmm.
One generates content and the other one discriminates. So the one generates a picture of somebody and the discriminator goes, "Nah, that's not very good. This is the best one of the ones you've thrown at me, develop from that one." And slowly but surely you get more and more compelling content created by this sort of back and forth between the two neural networks.
Mm-hmm.
To the point where you have a picture of a person who has never existed,
right,
but it looks spot on. Or it could be a video, or it could be voice.
Yeah.
And so now you can generate new content that is completely infallible because this is like an individual who's never existed. You can leave trails around the internet that make it look like this person has a social media presence,
right,
and has a history. And all of a sudden, the machines like that have a massive advantage over little old us who are sitting there looking out for another person like us who might be scamming us. And so the victims are outgunned here. I can't foresee terribly many useful applications of AI to give them weapons to defend against this kind of exploitation.
Mm.
Another example of something that could, be AI, artificial intimacy going bad, is sort of dating assistants that you have in your pocket or on your phone or whatever that help you with conversation, that sort of mine the internet for information about somebody and then, throw up lines that you might use or interests that you might profess to have so that you're able to, you have an unfair advantage in conversation with him.
Mm-hmm.
It's a much more subtle kind of cheating, but ultimately what are you left with it? If a relationship does start, at some point that relationship is based on complete dishonesty. Any number of possible applications like that could and probably will arise. If you think pickup artistry, there are those people who study the techniques of game.
Yeah.
Well, if there's game to be discovered, if there are true insights into human nature of mating to be had and applied, I trust AI to find them quicker than any evolutionary psychologist.
Mm. I think the problem is we're always trying to hack things, like how to hack productivity, how to hack this, how to hack dating, And if we have some type of virtual assistant, perhaps, then there is something disingenuous about that, or that could quickly become disingenuous. And I think that's the problem, is that it starts off fine. It gives you a tip about what to say, or maybe what to order or something like that. But where it goes askew is if you become too reliant on this, you get into deception, which plays into sexual sexual conflict. I think even this could happen with males or females using this, or I think where it would really play out is in the online dating game. Say you're using Hinge or Tinder or Bumble or any other number of these websites. You could put in the messages that the other person is sending you, and then AI will come up with what to say in response. And you're not even really involved anymore. You have an algorithm speaking for you. So I think certainly that's one area that you've alluded to where this could go askew. Another thing I want to point out is you mentioned the deepfake scenario in which we create something out of nothing. We create a person who's never existed before, and we leave little breadcrumbs all over the internet to indicate that they do in fact exist. I think another problem with this, which is insidious on multiple levels, is using deepfakes of people who do exist, of existing people who might have a social media profile and have a LinkedIn, Facebook, whatever, and using a deepfake to sort of impersonate them. And then you, hypothetically, unsuspecting victim, would think that you're engaged in some type of relationship or have some kind of online intimacy with you know, a person that you've actually never spoken to. You've spoken to a deepfake version of them. So it can go wrong on a few different levels, I think.
It sure can, you know. And I suppose that, I don't know if I'm being unfair here, but I have a sense that the folks who are at the cutting edge of this technology, who are best able to, you know, work as solo operators and get into this kind of thing, is the kind of the hacker demographic.
The people who need it most.
Yeah, exactly. at least that hacker demographic is going to target a particular other demographics like them. And I don't know that I had anything sensible to say about that. So I might just leave that comment.
Well, look, I think perhaps what you're alluding to or what I'm extrapolating from this is that this is not going to play into particularly fair or necessarily scrupulous sexual practices of, you know, people designing technology to deceive future mates who are targeting others who also are more inclined to rely upon deception. Quickly becomes a self-perpetuating cycle of, shall we say, members of society who, you know, maybe they are left behind a little bit, but certainly I think that this would exacerbate like dark triad traits to a large degree. It's deceivers creating technology for more deceivers, or narcissists creating technology that has an especially potent use for other narcissists, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I think that says it decidedly better than I could have, I think.
You know, I think technology also has very visceral real-life consequences as well. You mentioned some of the incel shootings that happened earlier. And, you know, just the other day, you know, I saw that, pardon my butchering the pronunciation here, but Rohingya Muslims are suing Facebook for $150 billion at the moment because of some of the violence that they allege was perpetuated via Facebook's platform. So we're seeing this enter the sort of cultural or legal arena already. And there's always this question, is Facebook responsible for January 6th? Is Facebook responsible for the Rohingya Muslims? Not, by the way, let me make very clear on the record that those are completely different events and not at all the same thing. Nowhere near on the same level of they're just it's apples and oranges, but they're both examples anyway of times in which people have pointed to Facebook as an exacerbator of violence. So to that end, I think that's just another example that we see of a debate anyway about whether it's technology that's causing the violence or whether technology is just really good at, you know, maybe bringing out the worst in people who are already bad.
Yeah, I think that's fair. What these technologies do is that they amplify things, and they have the potential to amplify the message from somebody who, under no other circumstance in history, would have had their words amplified by anybody other than their immediate circle of friends, if that. Mm. So, you know, here's another mismatch. You have these algorithms that are designed to stoke engagement and to keep people on platform, irrespective of whether that's, you know, good or bad, and mostly, you know, in the full knowledge that the things that keep people on platform are things that are completely unsalubrious. Mm. So, you know, the Rohingya question is a very interesting one. I'm going to be very interested to see how the class action in the United States and the lawsuit that's being lodged in the United Kingdom go, because the notion here is that, you know, Facebook didn't do anything and actually really didn't do anything. They didn't respond when they knew that, you know, messages were being spread that were basically calling the government, you know, identifying people that the government should come and chase away or you know, basically be violent towards. And you know, the government did that and caused this, you know, 1 million person migration into Bangladesh and, you know, a huge loss of life and huge violence to the people who were left behind. And yeah, you can go viral as an individual and you can spread any kind of message. And for a lot of people, there's obviously this very strong question about whether or not platforms can remain agnostic about what it is that they're perpetuating. And boy, is that an interesting free speech question that's not going to go away.
It certainly is. It's going to be fascinating to see how this plays out over time. And while we're on the subject of Facebook, let's talk about the metaverse. I'll leave this as sort of an open-ended question. There's nothing specific I necessarily want to ask other than, you know, writ large, you know, how do you think this whole concept of the metaverse might begin to sort of alter the human social experience? And asking from an evolutionary perspective here.
So I have trouble getting a full sense of what people are so excited about with the metaverse. I mean, I think that the real, you know, cutting edge tech people see it as, you know, a bunch of independent sort of platform neutral spaces where we can interact in, you know, with our normal tools as well as the tools of VR and the things that we're currently doing on the internet, et cetera. And I think that what they're most excited about is that platform neutral component, probably especially right now with, you know, Facebook and what do they call now Meta Corporation, you know, eyeing it out and looking to be the leader and looking to make it no longer platform independent, I imagine. But, you know, in some respects, I think we're well and truly partway there in that there are, you know, we our online life is our real life. Our social media is part of our real social life. And it's just the virtual reality component that's yet to come on, you know, completely. Now, virtual reality has been promising all sorts of things for decades now, and it's never quite delivered. You know, Google Glass isn't the revolution that we thought it was going to be. And in the book, I'm very bullish about virtual reality sex because I think that the combination of virtual reality, you know, vision plus sound plus, you know, haptics to do touch with and teledildonics to do that special kind of adult touch with is a, you know, it's a compelling mix. And I think the notion that we might end up having relationships with VR characters that have their own personalities but can hold, you know, a consistent, coherent relationship with a human user, I think is an enticing but quite distant possibility. And I think that that's kind of cool. So, you know, we'll be in something like the Matrix, you know, without the sinister kind of human battery components. Although, you know, maybe that's just a metaphor for the way things drain our attention. The only thing about the metaverse that I'm really, you know, puzzling about is Facebook's, you know, super strong commitment to it. It's not that puzzling because you know, they're well aware from their experience in, you know, the rise of social media and of mobile devices is that, you know, if you control the platform, then you can control the advertising revenue and you basically can dominate the attention economy in a way that they do alongside a bunch of other platforms now. You know, I guess they're hoping to be the only one. And I think that that would be a disaster for humanity.
Yeah, fair enough. Fair enough. We could always just retreat into the forest and live as, you know,
Put away the phone, people.
Yeah, exactly. Just go off into the woods, live in our tree houses, and never look back.
Yeah. I mean, I think the thing is you can make compelling content on computers. We've been making it for half a century now, and it gets more and more compelling. Why? Because we have, you know, product design and now machine learning is the most potent improvement algorithms ever, converging on what works mostly to keep us on platform and to dominate our attention, to sell it to advertisers, but nonetheless, what's efficient. And, you know, yeah, you can dip into it for fun. But, you know, just because there's a chocolate fountain in the lobby of a party that you're at, that doesn't mean you should spend the whole night dipping marshmallows in chocolate and eating them.
Yeah.
Taste it and move on.
Yeah. I guess one, you know, not to be doom and gloom, but, you know, we've talked about this in the past and, you know, it's especially relevant, it's perennially relevant, I think. But some of these new technologies across the three verticals, I guess, of artificial intimacy that you've mentioned are, or at least can be, a gold mine for dark triad individuals. So I guess my question is, what can be done to combat this? Obviously, within the sexual marketplace, just like any other marketplace, we want to root out cheaters or essentially defectors, those who aren't cooperating. We want to identify them and we want to spitefully punish them, sometimes even at a cost to ourselves. I think that's pretty well established at, you know, Ultimatum game experiments. I mean, tip of the iceberg. It is a fairly well-established concept. So I guess, you know, my question has to do is, within this new space that we're occupying with all of these new technologies, with artificial intimacy that exists across these three areas, how do you see this, you know, I guess the marketplace of human interaction regulating against dark triad individuals? Will, like anything else, they be selected out for in the cases that they're exposed, and then the few who slip through the cracks will, you know, can be quite successful? Like, will it be enough for us to identify and root them out? Or with the advent of some of these new artificial intimacy technologies, it seems like that's going to be quite hard. So there might need to be some kind of oversight or rules or limit to what we can or should use them for. I guess what I'm getting at here is the question of what can be done to combat dark triad individuals from, you know, doing bad things with these new technologies.
It's a great question, you know, and in a way it's an extension of all the things that are bad about the internet right now, particularly, you know, just trolling and abuse. You know, humans have this amazing capacity that we evolved during the most crucial part of our evolutionary past, which was the capacity to talk to each other and to gossip and to share news. And that's how historically we've managed to pick up on, you know, who's a narcissist and who's a psychopath and who is Machiavellian and how to deal with them, you know. And those traits, the people with those traits, can never get too frequent, too common, because, you know, the more common they get, the better, the more alert we are to them and to what their tricks are.
Right.
And therefore, you know, the better people are at simply neutralizing them one way or another. Now, online, the gossip that we share online isn't anchored in, you know, genuine identity of individuals. We just don't know who's who. You can be a shape-shifting narcissist from another dimension relatively easily, because you can just bounce around and do your narcissistic stuff or your psychopathic stuff with relative impunity, because it never ties back to who you are specifically. So,
and even if you're caught, you move on to another platform kind of thing.
You know, whereas
that's deeply disconcerting.
You know, we have reputation. And certainly in small communities, workplaces, et cetera, where we can more or less, you know, we're not perfect at it, but we can stop them from running the complete show, usually. In a workplace, you can identify somebody who's behaving self-interested or destructive kind of a way. You know, not so good in politics at dealing with it, and probably increasingly worse at dealing with it. And then, of course, we have sort of third-party justice, which kind of keeps the worst actors off the street, or at least aims to get them off the street as much as possible. But the internet's not like that, and it's never really come up with a fail-safe solution to this, or even a solution that works well most of the time. And so with artificial intimacy, I think that the potential for these technologies to be used in the most vulnerable types of human interactions and to potentially pervert those most vulnerable interactions is really profound. And I think that's probably, if anything's going to slow the uptake of artificial intimacy and is going to just turn people off it completely and turn them back to, you know, in real life with real people, it's going to be that.
Yeah.
You know, I think that's the only real solution there is, until you can know exactly who's who on the internet and what they're doing. And I don't think that the people who make the internet as it currently is, I don't think the people who are aiming to be the dominant force in making the metaverse are
necessarily are concerned with ensuring the veracity of each user.
No, I don't think so. So, you know, it is a bit of a downbeat observation, but I don't have any obvious solutions. You know, I mean, I think, you know, you think in trolling, in the use of technology in stalking, harassment, violence, etc., there are the odd groups that will come in and work for the greater good. I think of the badass army who deal with, you know, this sort of not quite hacker group, but a group that deals with the use of technology and around questions of intimate partner violence. But, you know, that's sort of vigilantes, I suppose.
Yeah.
But, you know, mostly the people who are good with computers are wearing the black hats.
Well, thank you so much, Rob Brooks, for coming on the podcast. It was a pleasure. And look forward to keeping in touch.
Thanks for having me on the show, Scott.